I belong to Yorktown Zen. We meditate here on a Saturday morning, studying with Paul Thiessen. And of the many things that he does to encourage our spiritual practice, what I value most highly is a glowing coal. It's a story about a young seeker who goes to meditation weekend, and Saturday morning, she's poking through the ashes from Friday night's fire, not having too much luck. And the Zen master sits down next to her. They poke through the ashes together, come up with a few glowing coals, which they fan, and the fire is rekindled. Paul Thiessen has told us a story that when he first began to study in Japan at a northern monastery, there was an older Irish-American woman there named Maura. And he was 18 with his hormones flowing, hitting on her, and she, like a skilled matador, was leading him to one side and leading him to the other side. One time she came over to him and said, "Are you serious or are you just visiting?" And there have been many occasions. My definition of a glowing coal is a story that does not lose its significance and meaning and intensity over time. And there's many times now when I was in a position of needing to question my level of commitment and would say to myself, "Are you serious or are you just visiting?" So if you listen carefully to the stories that Paul Thiessen will share with you, you might find the glowing coal for yourself.
Thank you. Bob, you worked on that. Yeah. I remember the first time I came here, he introduced me, he said, "Yeah, he's okay." Good to see y'all again. So I'm going to start with two apologies. First, I have this annoying cough. So I've been taking cough drops. So it's not rude. I'm trying not to cough through this whole thing. So that's the first apology. Second is, as many of you know, including Josh, my family is very involved with the Scouts. My wife is away with two of my kids on a scouting camp out this weekend, so I'm home with the other two, and one of my chores today is to get my daughter to her 12 o'clock dance class. So as soon as I'm done, I kind of have to dash off to get her there. So I don't mean to be rude, not to stick around, but hopefully you understand and forgive me. Yeah, it's okay. Sometimes people say, "What's it like being a Zen teacher?" That's what it's like being a Zen teacher, getting your daughter to her 12 o'clock dance class. But even though I have to leave abruptly, I think you all know that I'm accessible to you all the time anyway. Part of the arrangements that we have, you know, we've had this really extraordinary relationship, friendship, partnership over the last 4 or 5 years now. Where the UU has extremely generously and compassionately given us a home, Yorktown Zen, to come and do our practice, which we are always so grateful for. But part of that arrangement is that I'm accessible to all members of the UU whenever you need. So please don't be shy. If you want to chat, reach out. For those of you who, apparently there's some new folks here today, I'd encourage you to deeply consider the UU as your congregation. It's an incredible community of caring, loving, compassionate people. I can't think of a better place to build relationships and spend a Sunday morning. So if you're new here, come back. It's a great place. So Bob Doshin asked me, he gave me the topic of to talk about Zen stories. Not my stories, quote unquote, Zen stories. So that's easier said than done. What I want to do is kind of explain what a Zen story is, because they fall in many categories. And what's interesting to me is storytelling isn't part of the Buddhist tradition per se. It's very much a part of the Abrahamic tradition. If you look at the Old Testament, it's basically all stories, right? The morals, the teachings are through stories. And as you progress from the Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran, it's all, the spine of all of them is storytelling. It gets a little bit preachier, honestly, as you kind of move into the later books, but all of that is based on storytelling. That's not the case with Buddhism. Buddhism came out of basically a Hindu culture where you have Shakyamuni Buddha, the great Buddha. He has his great enlightenment, and he says, you know, the Hindus are already really good at storytelling. Like, they're awesome. We don't need to do that. I'm just going to talk about the nature of mind and consciousness and how we become deeply realized human beings. And that's basically all we talked about in the beginning. Just kind of creating a map of the mind and the heart and how we can transform our afflicted lives into a life without pain and suffering, and how we can be bodhisattvas, how we can help others alleviate their pain and suffering. That's basically what he taught. But over time, I think the subsequent ancestors said, you know, that's all good, well and good, but we need to find other ways to communicate these messages. So storytelling started to come in. The oldest probably being the Lotus Sutra. It's a series of, I think it's the oldest publication actually in the world. There's a series of stories, and they're accompanied by teachings. And it starts to transform as Buddhism and different schools of thought evolve out of the different schools of Buddhism. The Zen coming out of Mahayana, which is the path of Buddhism that went through the north, through Tibet, through India, Tibet, China, and Korea, Japan. And as it reached each of those cultures, it took on the flavor of those countries, those cultures, and started to change. So I want to share with you some of the different kinds of what we call Zen stories. Some are more like Aesop fairy tales, right, which have a more moral in them. They're pretty obvious. They're not deep, you know, philosophical or esoteric teachings. They're just sort of like how to be a better person, or you know, what's the best way to live your life. I'm going to actually finish with one of those tonight, which is kind of humorous. Then you get these other ones, which are kind of Buddhist or Zen light, I call them. They're sort of like, they're not deep Zen teachings, but they give you a kind of a flavor. If you're interested in Zen, these stories will give you a flavor of what it's like. Then you get other stories that remind me of sort of the stories we have about George Washington and, you know, the cherry tree and Abe Lincoln splitting the log. There's stories of these great Zen masters who, it's not really important if the story's true or not. If the story's all about giving you a sense of who that teacher is and their essence and their values. And in Japan in particular, these great Zen masters like Ryokan, Hakuin, Ikkyu, there are these stories that are out there that every Japanese kid knows. They read about them in their books. So I'm going to share one of those stories with you tonight as well, this afternoon, this morning. There's a lot around this particular Zen master Ikkyu. The Japanese love Ikkyu stories because they're very, very funny. Unfortunately, humor doesn't translate across cultures. So whenever you tell an Ikkyu story and you're expecting a big guffaw, like Americans, like, that's not funny. So I'm gonna skip the Ikkyu stories. Japanese love them. Americans just don't think they're very funny. And then we start to move into stories that give you a sense of what the experience of Zen is, right? So if you're kind of interested, I'm thinking of coming to meditate, I'm thinking of it, what should I expect? There's some stories around that to give a flavor. Then the last category are actual Zen stories that we use in Zen training. I've come here and I've talked before about koans, these Zen puzzles that we meditate on. They're highly kind of irrational. The whole point of them is they melt the brain and let all logic and self-control, self-interest kind of flow away so that one's intuition and greater nature come through. The Zen stories often, at the very end, have something called a turning phrase, a turning word. It's something that comes at the very end, and this is supposed to open up your consciousness a little bit. And we use these stories in actual Zen training. We meditate on them, and we have these where you meet with the master, the teacher, and there's instruction, and you kind of come to another state of consciousness through these stories. So there's all kinds of different stories. Let me give you an example of one that is gives you a sense of Zen thinking without being an actual training story, okay? So for example, a family moves to a new town, and they're looking around, and they see a Zen temple, and they think, oh, I'm gonna pop into the Zen temple and get a sense of what this new town is like and get the true story from the priest. So they go in, they meet the priest, and they say, excuse me, priest, we just moved here, and we want to know what this town is like. Can you tell us, honestly? And the Zen priest says, well, what was the town like where you came from? And they say, it was awful. The people were awful. The environment was awful. We couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. It was just, everything about it was terrible. And the Zen teacher says, well, I'm sorry to tell you, you're going to find this town to be the same. So they get further, very despondent, they leave. And so it happens, another family just moves in. They do the same thing. They pop in. They say, excuse me, Zen teacher, we just moved here. We don't know much about this place. Can you tell us about it? And the Zen teacher says, well, what was your last town like? And they said, it was delightful. The people were great. It was so great to live there. We only moved here because we had to for work. It was just a wonderful, wonderful place to live. And the Zen teacher says, well, I have to tell you, you're going to find this place to be exactly the same. So it really, it gives you a sense of, it's what you bring to the picnic, right? Your perspective is your reality. What you project, how you see your life and take in your life is your life, right? So you see these people all the time talking about how divisive the times are and how chaotic they are, but well, that's going to be your life, right? If you see your life with love and compassion and beauty and the miracle of it all, that's going to be your life. You will determine it. And your state of consciousness, your heart, your mind creates your life. So that's an example of not a teaching that we meditate on, but it certainly gives a sense of the Zen approach or the Zen thinking about mind. So I didn't want to screw up these stories, so I actually wrote them down. I'll read them to you so they're more succinct. So here's an example of a story about a Zen master. Again, if it's true or not true, don't know. In this particular Zen master, you may have heard of him, his name is Ryokan. He was very famous for his paintings and his poetry. He was also very well known for his life of being ascetic, essentially. So he was very impoverished. He didn't have any physical property or own things that he owned, but spiritually, he was always glowing, apparently. So here's a story about Ryokan, which again, this story every Japanese kid knows. They've all read it. A Zen master lived the simplest kind of life in a little hut at the foot of a mountain. One evening, a thief visited the hut, only to discover there was nothing in it to steal. Ryokan returned and caught him. "You may have come a long way to visit me," he told the prowler, "and you should not return empty-handed. Please, take my clothes as a gift." The thief was bewildered. He took the clothes and slunk away. Ryokan, naked, watching the moon, said, "Poor fellow. I wish I could give him this beautiful moon." So, again, it just tells you all about Ryokan. No cherry trees. It's more these Zen stories tend to be a little bit more poetic. They're often, when people read them from a Western point of view, we think they're sardonic or ironic or cynical or sarcastic. Like, we see a kind of cynicism or twist at the end. But in reality, it's not sardonic, it's not cynical or sarcastic at all. It's actually the teaching. They're actually quite sincere. So let me give you two quick ones that give you a sense. If you were thinking about doing Zen practice, what that experience might be like, stories around that, kind of intro to that world. So one goes, a martial arts student went to his teacher and said earnestly, "I am devoted to studying," and this is, it's martial arts, but it applies to the Zen training. "I am devoted to studying your martial arts system. How long will it take to master it?" The teacher's reply was casual, and he said, 10 years. Impatient, the student answered, "But I want to master it faster. Faster than that. I will work very, very hard. I will practice every day, 10 or more hours a day, if I have to. How long will it take then?" Teacher thought for a moment and said, 20 years. There are very similar stories in Zen with the exact same scenario of a Zen monk going to a Zen master and getting the very different response than expected. When I see this story, it reminds me a little bit of when I was a kid, well, college. I had friends that went off to the Peace Corps. Like, we were all doing different things. So I had friends that went to Peace Corps because they wanted to, in Africa, because they wanted to make, you know, the continent a better place to live. There was a lot of poverty, starvation. So they went off, and I reconnected with them a couple years later and was very excited. You know, there was no internet back then, so I didn't know everything was happening while they were there. But speaking to them afterwards, I said, "So how was your experience in Africa?" And they were a little bit disappointed. I said, why are you disappointed? They said, "Well, we just weren't that successful. We had all the best intentions. We really wanted to do a great job, but we just didn't do very well over there." And I said, "Well, tell me why. I'm really interested." And they said, "Well, we went over because the system they used to farming is so antiquated and old, you just don't get any yield. You know, we want to show them the American way, where for the same square footage, you can produce 10 times as much, right? With the machinery and the fertilizers and all this stuff that we have." So we were so excited to get the grants and go over there and turn this land that's really quite barren into something that's really fertile. So we went over there, and it took a while to convince some of these villagers to do it. But they finally trusted us, and they did it. And we started to ramp up operations, and it was great. We really started to turn this dust into soil, usable soil. Okay, that sounds wonderful. So what's the problem? They said, "Well, like with anything, things break, right? So you have a tractor, you lose a nut, you lose a bolt, or something has to be, the engine has to be fixed. But there's no one there to fix it. They don't have the parts. They don't have that critical part of the fertilizer, right? Those little tiny things, and all of a sudden, the whole system falls apart because they can't replace it and train it." So these villagers that had given up their traditional ways of farming we're now using the Western ways of farming, but none of the machines or any of the things that we had introduced to them were working either. So they were really quite desperate. So it went from being subsistence to being a calamity, right? And it broke their heart. And that's what this reminds me of. Sometimes we go into things with such energy, right? We want to do the best. We're going to go even harder and really commit. But without a kind of consciousness or awareness of the impact of the karma, if you will, the cause and effect, in many cases, it winds up being worse, right? And that was an example of that. So you have the student that's like, yes, I'm work harder and harder and harder. It's actually going to push you back 20 years, right? Sometimes we just have to be quiet, be attentive, and let nature unfold the way it's supposed to. That is our process in our practice, right, to some degree. So this story is a way of looking at that. There's another one which those of you here who are actually in Yorktown Zen and have sat will relate to. It goes like this. A student went to his meditation teacher and said, my meditation is horrible. I feel so distracted. My arms and legs are moving around all the time. I'm constantly falling asleep. My meditation is horrible. The teacher says, it will pass. Very matter of fact. A week later, student comes back to the teacher and says, my meditation is wonderful. I feel so aware, so peaceful, so grounded, so alive. It's just wonderful. To which the teacher replies, it will pass. So I'm sure every one of you who have sat have this experience. And we talk all the time in Yorktown Zen about, it's just about the practice. It's not if it's good or it's bad. You just put the time in. You just keep practicing. You just keep doing it. And what will evolve the way it's supposed to. So let me share with you a couple that are actually used as Zen koans. They're really quite, again, they have a turning phrase at the end, which you can sit with and stay with for a while, because the longer you stay with it, the deeper it gets and more it resonates. So I have two for you. One is, one day a young Buddhist on his journey home came to the banks of a wide river. Staring hopelessly at the great obstacle in front of him, he pondered for hours on just how to cross such a wide barrier. Just as he was about to give up his pursuit to continue his journey, he saw a great teacher on the other side of the river. The young Buddhist yells over to the teacher, "O wise one, can you tell me how to get to the other side of this river?" The teacher ponders for a moment, looks up, looks down, looks around the river, and yells back, "My son, you are on the other side." And this is one very early in the koan process. The student will have this koan to meditate on. And it's not an easy one to penetrate, frankly. But it's worth the time being with it. It's a classic, actually. Two men are arguing about a flag flapping in the wind. "It's the wind that is really moving," stated the first one. "No, it is the flag that is moving," contended the second. A Zen master, who happened to be walking by, overheard the debate. Was it the wind moving or was it the flag moving? The master interrupted them and said, "Neither the flag nor the wind is moving," he said to them. "It is the mind that moves." Does that blow your mind? Is that like I think when I had this koan as a young monk, I probably was on it for 2 months. Just constantly. That was my, what does that mean? What the hell does that mean? Come on, Tom, what does it mean the mind's moving? But that's a more classic kind of a Zen koan, something we would meditate on. So let me give you one more. This falls under the category more, like I was talking about the Aesop fables, right? It's neither classically Zen or Buddhist in its teaching. There's a moral to it. What I really love about this is, although it's a famous Japanese story, I think it really transcends culture. And that's why I love it. And you know, by the way, in ancient times, it's really hard to think about it now, but in ancient cultures, like the Inuits, I believe, they would take their elderly and put them on a float, right? When they're no longer of value, and send them off. Japanese famously would take their elderly people to the top of a mountain and leave them there. And there was no mess. You're looking like, your parents are saying, don't listen to this right now. We don't do this anymore. But economically, it didn't make any sense, right, to have them around. They were taking up resources and making it difficult for everyone else to live. So no one, the elderly didn't complain. It was just the natural way of life, right? So this story is somewhat based on that. A farmer got so old that he couldn't work the fields anymore. So he would spend the day just sitting on the porch. His son, still working the farm, would look up from time to time and see his father just sitting there. "He's of no use anymore," said the son. Well, that's good. Is that me? "He's of no use anymore," the son thought to himself. "He doesn't do anything." One day the son got so frustrated by this that he built a wood coffin, dragged it over to the porch, and told his father to get in. Without saying anything, the father climbed inside. After closing the lid, the son dragged the coffin to the edge of the farm where there was a high cliff. As he approached the drop, he heard a light tapping on the lid from inside the coffin. He opened it up. Still lying there peacefully, the father looked up at his son and he said, "I know you're going to throw me over the cliff, but before you do it, may I suggest something?" "What is it?" said the son. "Throw me over the cliff, if you like," said the father, "but save this good wood coffin. Your children might need to use it." I love this story because I could hear my Jewish grandmother saying this, right? Or Italian grandfather. It's like any culture, you could, yeah, just save the wood. Yeah, that's fine. Throw me over the cliff. It's okay. Anyway, it's a fantastic story. But, you know, when the stories are truthful, they really do transcend all cultures. But anyway, that gives you a sense of, you know, there's this very, very rich culture. And it's good to have the teachings and the Dharma, but sometimes a turning phrase, a little story goes a long way. So I hope you enjoy those.